This is Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We're back after a 5-minute glitch. So probably you weren't listening a minute ago, because I'm not sure we were really here. But now you can tune in on any internet access device at www.enlightenradio.org. Today is February 20th, and it's Monday at noon, so you're listening to the Epic Storytelling Hour. This is your host, Fanny Crawford, for the Storytelling Hour, and I'm about to reintroduce our guest today, Eloise Schottler, storyteller and storytelling role model for me, who's joining us by phone from Montgomery County. Hi, Eloise. I'm sorry for that delay.
Oh, glitches are what makes things interesting, and that gives us a story, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. We are creating story here on the air.
Yeah, I'm awfully glad to be here with you, Fanny.
Well, great. I'm so glad you're here with your patient self as we get our act together. So you're here because I asked you to come and talk about World War I and your story, Ready to Serve, and the nurses of Johns Hopkins University Hospital. So give us a little introduction to that, and then I'm going to break to go to calendar updates. But I do want our listeners to know what we're talking about today.
Okay, we're talking about it. I'm living in Chevy Chase, Maryland. I'm a storyteller for a long time. I'm a senior teller. And 2 or 3 years ago, I decided I wanted to tell stories about World War I. It was coming up, you know, the 100-year centennial this year. And I had found a story about switchboard operators, and after I was working on that for a while, I wanted a second. You know, you like to have a pair. A
sure,
pair.
Yeah.
And so I found a story that I call Ready to Serve. 64 nurses who graduated from Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in Baltimore. And they went to France with the base hospital number 18, the hospital that Johns Hopkins took to France in 1917. It's a heartfelt story for me because in 1954, I came to Maryland from Charlotte, North Carolina to be a nurse at Johns Hopkins. Of course, I met my prince, and I dropped out of nursing school and got married about halfway through. So these women are sort of ancestral for me, foremothers, and I love telling their story, and it's a very interesting story.
It is. It's a fascinating story. So we're going to give you time to talk more about that and maybe about some of the other work that you've done around World War I. But what I usually do... once we're settled, and I think we're good now with technology, I share some calendar updates. So you may be interested in these also.
I definitely will be.
Okay. We usually start with Speak, Adam Booth's storytelling venue here in Shepherdstown. And Speak has been on hiatus for a couple winter months, but starting back on April 18th, which this time is the third Tuesday of the month. After April, Adam goes back to the second Tuesday. But on April 18th, in order to get Antonio Rocha here, Brazilian-American storyteller and mime, for that 1 month, Speak will be meeting on the third Tuesday. So you want to get your tickets early. There's a good chance that that show will sell out. And you can do that by contacting Adam through the website at www.speakwv.org. You can also call Adam directly at 304-886-9481 or email him at info@speakwv.org. And I haven't checked this week, but he may have more of the roster for the coming year up on the website. This is Speak's fifth season. It's been a wildly successful program. The speakers tell, or most of the speakers tell in the schools, as well as doing that evening program. So April 18th, 7 p.m. at the Shepherdstown Community Club, $10 in advance, $12 at the door, and you can contact Adam via www.speakwv.org. Another storytelling venue, Stories in the Round, that I coordinate in Hagerstown, Maryland at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 13245 Sear Foss Pike. That's at the west end of town, just past the Walmart Shopping Center on Sear Foss Pike. That's Route 56. 58, I'm sorry. We start up again after our winter break on April 24th, and Eloise Schottler will be our opening performer, and we have Eloise on the line right now for our interview today. So hang on, listeners, and you will get to hear more from Eloise and about what she'll be telling on April 24th. Stories in the Round meets the fourth Monday of the month, April through December. $10 in advance, $12 at the door, and you can register and get tickets by calling me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638 or via email at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.org. Another storyteller who's been with us in the past and who has some performances coming up is Eileen Evans, who's another West Virginia storyteller like Adam Booth is. And Eloise will be telling on March 22nd at Eastern West Virginia Community and Technical College, which is not too far from Shepherdstown. It's a ways, but you can do it. Karen Varanch will be performing with her as Pearl S. Buck, and Eileen will be portraying Aslanda Robeson, who you may know, our listeners may know, as the wife of Paul Robeson, but she was also an artist and writer in her own right. And Karen Varanch and Eileen Evans will be having conversations in those roles as Pearl Buck and Aslanda Robeson. That's 12:15 in the afternoon on March 22nd. And you can get more information by contacting Eileen herself at 304-288-6255 or at www.vfte, which stands for Voices from the Earth, vfte.org, or info@vfte.org. And Eileen's also going to be doing a 3.5-day workshop under the auspices of Voices from the Earth, and that workshop is In the Voice of Our Ancestors. This is an annual event that she does most years. I went a couple years ago, and this time she's opening the workshop to men and women of all backgrounds. The only requirement, Eileen says, is an interest and study of ancestor stories. So maybe I'll see some of our listeners there at that workshop. But right now, back to Eloise. Eloise, you're telling us about Ready to Serve and how you came to that story.
Yes, I am. You know, that because I was a dropout from Hopkins, that's the only way that I would have known that they had a World War One. And it's so funny because at the time in 1954, there were probably some of these women, there were 64 of them, that were near retirement age walking the halls, working off their last years, you know, private duty nursing, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And who knew? Who knew? Because they never talked about them. They never talked about these women that had gone overseas in World War One. We were still so engaged in World War Two and the wars that were going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a wonderful time finding out about them, why they went, learning a little bit about World War One. You know, the United States entered World War One on April the 6th, 1917. So this is the 100th anniversary of their going to war. And there had been preparations beforehand. The Hopkins had a hospital ready to go, and it was supplied by the Red Cross. And when they put out their call, and I've read these files at the Chesney Archives at Hopkins University, and it was just thrilling to look at all these little notes that said, I am ready to serve. I am ready to serve. And they were. So they chose 64, and on June the 8th, they took the train, that group, to the docks at, in New York City, got their uniforms and whatever, and they sailed on June the 14th, 1917, on a ship called the Finland. And they were sailing with, in a convoy, with the first troops to go over, the Big Red, from Big Red 1, from 1st Division, from out in Kansas. These were General Pershing's chosen soldiers to go. And as soon as they stepped off that boat and their feet touched French soil, they were no longer Red Cross nurses. They were nurses that were considered to be U.S. Army nurses. These are veterans. All the Red Cross nurses that served over became Army nurses are listed in all the files as U.S. Army veterans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of this was very exciting. They didn't know what to expect. They found a lot of differing kinds of things. What happened and where I got the most information about them was from a file in the Library of Congress, 57 letters from one person.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other letters that were in the alumni journals and other things that had been sent home there in the Hopkins archives. And, you know, what do you do when you've got 57 letters and you have all these things? To make a presentation that's going to give you the life of these people, I made this into a composite character who is not named. And she tells their stories in their words, because they all had essentially the same experience, but they all approached it a little bit differently. And as I began to write this program 2 years ago, I'm a senior teller. And I thought, well, I can't very well stand on the stage with my white hair and talk to you as though I'm 22 nor 40. And so I made this composite character to be an 80-year-old veteran in 1970 who tells her story for the first time.
That's
and
a
so
great,
she
great idea.
For all of them.
Yeah.
And I like to do that because my whole purpose in this in these programs is to bring these women to life so that you'll have a chance to know the kind of women they were and what they did, and mainly what they wrote home about was the patients, the boys that they were taking care of. So that's one way for the people who are listening to the story to have a sense of what happened to these young men and how they were taken care of. And I keep reading about them and reading about other situations. And you build it up so that there's more detail and that I can tell you more about the night that 250 men arrived at 11 to 1 o'clock in the night who had been gassed, and what that took and what the symptoms were and what they must have encountered as they were taking care of them.
I
love the story.
I've heard this story from you, Eloise, and it is so powerful, especially that episode with the gassing. I mean, I was not the only one with tears in my eyes who was really moved.
Well, you know, one of the women in her letters, she said, you know, I know that I won't remember their names, but I shall never forget these boys as long as I live. And that was how they felt about their role as nurses, you know, to take care of them. Now, right now, believe it or not, I've started another project for next year. I won't get it out this year. I'm telling Ready to Serve, I've told it so far in 8 counties in the state of Maryland, and I'd be following up from there. But I'll introduce a new story next year at the Capitol Fringe, and it's about the nurses, a very handful of nurses, who rode with the sanitary trains. And I had never heard of these. And this is nurses who rode on the trains that took the wounded, the seriously wounded, from the battlefield to hospitals or to where they could be put on a boat and sent home.
So this is still
and
World War One.
Actually under fire.
This is still World War One.
We don't know that about our women.
Right.
You know, that, we just don't know that. And that's sort of why I love these stories is the opportunity to tell you about these women who are totally unknown.
So the sanitary trains you're speaking of are still World War One. You're still in that
still World
period.
War One. Yeah. It's okay. Still World War One, right up there near the battlefield. And the women I'm talking about are from July 1918 till the end of the war.
Mm.
And the war ended in 1918. So they didn't let the women on the trains except for about the last 5 or 6 months of the war.
Mm.
And it made a big difference.
Yeah.
You know, because it was better for the soldiers who were amputees or gassed or whatever. And they're fascinating the way they did them, you know, with the way the cars were done and hooked together. So I'm just throwing that out as a little tempter. You know, that this story is so, everything about that war is so deep, and that there's so much that we don't know about it.
Yeah.
Because it sort of was overcome by World War II stories, you know,
sure.
for years.
Well, and
so it makes it more interesting to me.
And the stories of the women, you know, it's very rare for anybody to talk about them, and this is really the beginning of the of the military using women
That's right.
Nurses.
You know, and these women that were the Red Cross women of World War One were the beginning of what we know today is, you know, the Army Corps nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would get home, the fighting would stop, they would be let go, and there was no real stable crew of nurses they could call on. If a war started, they had to round them up. And the other thing is that comes out in this story is they had no rank. And if you're going to be in the Army, you're going to have a much harder time if you're not ranked, you know, if you're just nurse.
Yes.
And so their records read nurse, not any kind of rank, even the chief nurse. So all of those things had to be corrected by World War II. And they were sort of, but then most of the corrections occurred after that.
Well, let's take a pause for just a moment. I'll let you gather your thoughts, and I'm going to do a station identification.
Okay.
We're Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio. This is the Epic Storytelling Hour with your host, Fanny Crawford. You can tune in to us at www.enlightenradio.org. Eloise Schottler is our storyteller this morning, and she's telling us about the story of the nurses from Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in World War One, who were sent to France by General Pershing in 1917. And these mostly young women, the story of their time there and the difference they made for the men that they cared for. So, Eloise, you shared just a bit with us about how you first heard of this group because of your connection with the School of Nursing at Johns Hopkins. But what was so compelling to you about their stories that you just knew as soon as you heard about it you were going to tell their stories?
Well, by the time I came to them to get their stories, I had about many years of being an advocate for women and telling stories of women. I became a storyteller through genealogy and my personal genealogy. And as I began to learn who my women were in my line, then I told their stories. And it told me a lot about who I am, and good or bad, you know, there you have it. And so the more engrossed I became in that, I remember maybe 20 years ago, Fanny, I bought a letter in the back room of a bookstore in Charlotte, North Carolina. just papers. I stumbled over it, bought it, and in it was a letter from a woman, Mrs. Clarence Hotchkiss. She was a young woman from Portland, Oregon, who had been befriended by a very elder woman in Charlotte. That her husband was in uniform. He was shipped out to World War One, but he had been at Camp Green, the training camp that was outside Charlotte. And families took those men in for Sunday dinner or for friendship. So she had written a letter to Mrs. Stewart, telling her that I'm sorry I haven't written you. You know, he's gone overseas. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm running his business. And I'm taking my Red Cross course because I want to go over there. Well, of course, she wouldn't have been allowed if you had a relative or whatever in service overseas. Mm. They didn't pick you up to send you overseas. But out of that, I carried that thing around with me for 15 years when I would do stories about letters. You know, the voices of women from the past. And then I'd lead up to my mother, who was a... My father went to India in World War II and left her at home with three children. So there's that story. There's so many of them. And when I found her, I just sort of opened up my eyes to what it was like to have been in World War I. And that's where my interest in it. So I told my aunt about that. And then she told me about my grand uncle, who's buried in France. And I never knew about John Walter. And he died of the Spanish flu 6 days before the armistice. And his mother went over as a Gold Star pilgrim. Families had a choice after the war was over and the army organized itself for the reburials and everything. You could either bring the body home or you could leave it in the American cemeteries in France, and they would have Gold Star pilgrimages for the mothers, the wives, and go over. You know, my great-grandmother went one time. And to this most sad picture of my life, this poor woman sitting next to her son's grave in San Samuel, France. So there was just another sort of a family story kind of thing. And I think for me, storytelling is a way of reaching for personal stories, family stories. Or what I like about this work is that it's not my story, but it is. But I'm not talking about myself. Even I got bored with hearing stories about me. So it's been a wonderful relief to be telling other people's stories, but doing it to create another character. Does that make any sense? I just love this work.
Yeah, and that comes through so clearly in your descriptions, the idea of finding these letters that nobody has been reading, you know, that have been stuck in files for so many years, and bringing these women to life. It's such a powerful process.
When you read somebody's letter, they live in your hand. At least for me, they do.
Yes.
The story from... Hopkins is that I was a nursing student at Hopkins, and my husband was a second year medical student there when I met him. So my relationship with Hopkins Hospital, even though I'm not one of their graduates or anything, you know, has remained strong, and it's very important to me to be telling this. It's even more important that in June I'm going to tell this story at the World War I Memorial Building in Baltimore for the West Coast Association is having a symposium there for World War I. And those are the kinds of things that fill you up. I mean, they fill me up with gratitude for being a storyteller.
Have you met any of these families of the women, or when you tell at these different historic...
I've met one distant niece lives here, and I've talked to her. The touching experience I had with these is that I went to tell stories at a festival in Anderson, South Carolina, last year, and one of my nurses... is from Anderson, South Carolina, and I went out to her grave in Anderson at the Presbyterian Church in Anderson, and there's just a flat stone. There's no marker Mm-hmm. You know, as so many will be put on graves for men, of course. But there's no identification there that this woman was a veteran of World War One, and that just kind of riles you up, you know, or does me, that what can you do to give these women credit? Now, that's why, for me, and it plays in with most of my military stories that I tell, the role that the World War One veterans, that the Women's Military Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery on the edge of Arlington, and that if people have had women in their families who served in the military, call them up and register them. This is their goal, is to catch the history of women who've served in the American military. From the Revolutionary forward, they have it. And I guess I could just tell quickly that in 2012, my husband was buried in Arlington, and so I spent a lot of time out there. And I began to realize that I better find out who was all around us, because I would be there with him whenever. And I would like to have people to talk to, know who these people mm-hmm. were my favorite. So 2 years ago, I went to Charlotte. And I went, when I was in the Carolina room, I showed them the letter from Mrs. Clarence Hodgkiss. And I said, you know, do you have anything on this family? He was stationed here, you know, blah, blah, blah. So she looked them up, and they were from Portland. And that's the first time I found out that she was Grace Evangeline Hodgkiss.
Oh.
And then she read out the whole thing, and I nearly dropped the paper. It says she's buried in Arlington.
Ah.
Their husband died in the 50s, and then she died a year later, and they waited to bury both of them together. And he was a colonel in the World War One Army. And they're buried in Arlington. So the first thing I did when I got home was I went out to find her.
Sure.
She's only two blocks. She's a very near neighbor of mine.
Oh, what a great story.
Well, that kind of serendipity, when you start playing around with your family or anybody else's, is what just fascinates me about dealing with stories from history.
Yes, yes.
You know, and you do a lot of that, so you know what I'm talking about.
These are just wonderful stories. So because I've heard this story now a couple times, and one of the things that's so cool about being there with you when you tell these stories is watching and listening to the responses from the audience as you tell these stories. All the connections that you're making with people who are so interested in their own family history and are making connections for themselves with these stories that you're telling, even if they're not related to these people.
Oh, yeah. It's such a gift. It's such a gift.
So what has that been like? What kind of response do you get?
Well, many people come up and they talk afterwards, or they ask questions. You know, mostly the older, but some history interested people have wider questions. We've never been really taught about World War One, and so this brings up the issue of you know, what it was like to be in that war, where were they, what happened. But the first season I told it at the Fringe, the Capitol Fringe down in Washington, D.C., a woman came up to me afterwards, and I was so touched. She had tears in her eyes, and she said, I have a relative, sort of like my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, there's never been any information about how he might have been treated when he died.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, from this story and hearing how the nurses worked and how much they cared, I feel so much better.
Hmm.
And I heard from her within about 5 days. She said, how did you find out? And I use genealogy tools when I'm working on a story to check if I want to know something personal about one of the nurses. Even though I may not use it in the story, I like to know who they are. And so I use Ancestry.com, and I also subscribe to newspapers.com, as well as whatever I can find in libraries. But, you know, if I see a name in a Red Cross book or something, I'll go immediately and check them out to mm-hmm. see who they were, where they lived. And I said, well, do that. And in about 5 or 6 days, she wrote me back, and she had found them.
Mm.
She had found the nurse, her aunt, that had served overseas, and she had found where this uncle was buried. And she said she felt so much better, and that it had launched her into looking for her own family history.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, we came down to when I came and told the story at the Hagerstown Library. There's a librarian at your library in Hagerstown that collects everybody she can find, has it on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers, nurses, whatever. And she collects all this information. And it's incredible what she does, and that she's done it, and she's sharing it out. And what I've learned, just where I'm taking this story, where is it? I was looking to see if I could tell it, because y'all are up there close. May the 20th, Ready to Serve, is going to be in Westminster, Maryland. That's a Saturday. It's a Friday or Saturday, Celebrating America Weekend. And they decided to include, because they're doing World War One programming. And then there's one, let's see, where is it? It's up at Oakland, Maryland, Deep Creek Lake,
mm-hmm.
up in that area. And that's in June, I believe. I'm looking at the page, but I'm without my glasses off. And it's just amazing how many people are now really searching this out.
So if our listeners go to a website, to a library, yes. website, or write to your information?
I think what they should do is go to the website, and it's called www.weebly.com. And that's just a one-page website with something about the story, and then a list of where I'm going to be doing it between now and July. And then I've already started with September. It's like people woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, it's a centennial year, and I don't have anything for my program, but there's this old woman having Let's see if we can get a hold of her. You think I'm kidding?
No, you were right on the cusp here. This is with both your stories, you know, with the Hello Girls that you mentioned earlier. This is such important work, and this has just been very timely. It's wonderful that they're calling you. Then you're getting
well,
the word
is.
Out.
And the women at the World War One Museum, Memorial at Arlington, because they had helped me with the story I do about Arlington and Jim's burial. But I went to see them, and they said, why don't you do the Hello Girls? And I'd never heard of them. And when I heard that they were switchboard operators, I sort of did a little ho-hum, I don't think so. And then I read their story. And they came back. 213 signed up and went to Europe. They came back, and the Army denied them their benefits. And those women lobbied for 60 years, and they finally got their benefits in 1977.
Mm.
And of that 213, 18 were still living. But they won. But
yeah.
18 were still living. Well, they were my people. I mean, I'm one of those activists for women that will get out in the street. And so I decided I've got to tell this story, because nobody knows that they fought for their rights and that they got them. And I tell three characters, and we are out of time, I'm sure, but just to tell you this, I was taking it to tell it at the World War One Museum and Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri, and I called him 2 weeks before I was to be there and asked the curator if he had any new information that maybe I didn't have, and could I see it? And he said, well, if you called me 2 weeks ago, I would have said no. I said, have you got something? And he said, a man walked in here 2 weeks ago and gave me a complete uniform for a Hello Girl.
What an incredible gift.
What was her name? What was her name? And he said, Olive Shaw. And I started crying. That's one of my characters.
Mm.
And by the time I got out to the museum, he had told me he couldn't do it, but he did it. He had that uniform on a mannequin in a glass case. Mm. And I just stood there and cried. I mean, it was very touching to meet her in the flesh. And I think that's what can happen with this history.
I love the way you talk about these women as your characters. You know them so well. You've done your research on them. You've read their letters.
Oh, yeah.
You really.
And see, after they didn't get a lot of money. I mean, don't mistake that their families didn't get money or anything. They didn't. But Olive, who died when she was 92 or so, got an honors burial.
Mm.
And they couldn't have had that before. You know, that until they were really veterans, they couldn't have been buried with their flag
mm-hmm.
or had the honors burial. And so that's a very interesting story. She was a very interesting character. All of them were very interesting characters, actually. And the chief nurse was awarded a Distinguished Service Medal for bravery because they were in a fire near the battlefield. But who cares? Who knows?
Oh, my. Okay, so you just told us a little bit about the Hello Girls, but then you went back to Olive Shaw, who was one of the nurses. Is that?
No, she's a Hello Girl.
Okay.
He brought in, and he was the young volunteer lawyer that helped them write their testimony for the winning sessions in Congress. And he told her, he said, I think I'm going to need a uniform just so we can prove our case. And she gave it to him and said, keep it and do something worthwhile with it.
So
he had had it ever since the 70s.
So this is so important to know, too, that the Army dressed them as military personnel.
Yes.
And treated them, they had to follow all those rules, but they weren't treated as vets when they came home.
Yes. You know, so, and then you weren't veterans, and they weren't going to take that.
Yeah.
So they sort of self-organized, and they were, of course, three or four that were really stronger with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then because the next thing to know was World War II, was the Depression, and World War II, then all this, and they were having their families, you know, and so some would drop off the active roles of lobbying, and then others would drop off. There was one woman from Seattle who held on for the whole thing.
Mm.
And Olive was also involved for the whole thing. But I asked him, I called him, I got the number and called him, and I said, was she as active as I imagined her to have been? And he said, you couldn't possibly imagine her. He said, yes, but you couldn't have possibly imagined her. Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
Right? Because it takes somebody with that kind of a husband, you know, to keep going and going and going.
I've been remiss. Let me do a station identification here, and then we'll go back and chat some more, Eloise. This is Fanny Crawford, your storytelling host on the Epic Storytelling Hour. On Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, you can access us on any internet device, www.enlightenradio.org. We're chatting with Eloise Shuttler, who's been telling us a couple different stories about women who were active with the military in World War 1. And Eloise is so passionate about telling these stories because they have not gotten the recognition that they deserve. And it's only in recent years that the military has even acknowledged their role. And Eloise telling their stories and getting the word out means a lot, both to the families of these women and to the rest of us who feel like we just weren't told this history and we need to know about it.
Well, and that, I think that's what captured me years ago, not for this particular story, but for genealogy. I read a book one time that said, it started me off on it, about say what you can about your grandmother at your age, your great-grandmother at your age, your great-great-great-grandmother. And my story didn't go very far.
Mm.
And that sort of set me off, is that how do you find out who you are, and or where you came from, or you know what their lives were like. And I didn't find any kings or queens. I was very disappointed, but no kings or queens. But you know what I did find, and I think most of us do, survivors.
Mm.
Survivors, and from different kinds of circumstances, they survived. And that's very comforting. You know, it's very comforting to find that. So that just sort of finding genealogy and storytelling to get it out. I was getting my genealogy together, and my adult daughter said, beget, beget, beget. Then they died. That's boring, mother. And then I bumped into storytelling. And you do have to tell your story.
Yeah.
It's nothing if you don't get the story, is it?
And that takes some research. It takes digging around, as you say. So,
yeah.
So who were the women in your immediate life, the women in your childhood who got you started on this? What honed your vision as an artist?
My Aunt Catherine would have been the one. And it wasn't that she set out to be a storyteller. She was not. She was just innately, she was born to tell stories. But she also became that wonderful woman in families, if we're lucky enough to have them, who kept the history. She had the photographs. She had the stories. And so when I got interested in storytelling, I would go to her, and she had the scrapbooks. She had all those things that we needed. And one of the things, she was the last to marry. And so she had a brownie camera, you know, one of those brownie box cameras.
Yeah.
And she took all of our pictures, and she was sending me pictures of me and my parents and my siblings up until the time she died, that she just still had them.
Mm.
But the best story she ever gave, and I just called, I was going to ask her, we are a haunted family, and I wanted another ghost story. And, you know, right before the day he died, Walter came back and stood at the foot of his mother's bed in his uniform and waved goodbye to her.
Oh,
you know, now you can believe that or not. I haven't believed it.
This is your great uncle John Walters.
John Walter was his name.
Buried in
and
France.
They called him Walter, and she was taking a nap, and she woke up, and Walter was standing, and she wasn't notified of his death. Some screw up with the post office. Military sent her back all her letters, and he had died the day that she had that vision.
Mm.
So anyway, Cocky didn't want to talk ghost stories that day. She told me the story of the day that she joined the Army. She was in the WAC.
Mm.
And she joined the Army, and the day she and this other girl shipped out on the train to Omaha, Nebraska, where they trained. I think it was there. I'm not sure. And I tell that story in her voice, because she then later went to that girl's, that woman, old woman's funeral, and she had a flag on her coffin.
Hmm.
And Cocky was so afraid she wouldn't get her flag.
Oh.
And the last time I saw her, I went by her apartment, and she said, would you like to see my prized possession? I said, absolutely. What is it? And she went in her closet and brought out her WAC uniform.
Oh.
And she said, you people, you just don't understand. You don't understand how important that was.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
You know, when you can hear stories like that in your family, that this was not a woman who was important, but she was showing you what had been important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so wonderful, you know, so wonderful. So she's the one that really taught me that you collect them and that stories in the family are important.
And you called her Aunt Cocky. Do I have that right?
Name is Catherine. Yeah.
Okay.
But the children, her brothers and sisters, the cousins, we called her Cocky.
Mm.
And she is really quite a lovely woman.
Mm.
And eccentric.
Well, that's why she's a storyteller.
That's right. Those are the best times.
So she did get her flag? When?
Absolutely. She was buried in Wilmington, and she got her... I did a little thing. The family asked me to say something about her, and I reached over to touch her casket, and I could feel the rough fabric of that flag.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they buried her in Wilmington next to her husband, she had her flag, and she had two musicians there, and somebody played the trumpet, played taps.
Mm.
She got the whole thing.
Good for her.
She had the whole thing. Yeah, that's what I've always felt about it, too. I know she liked it. Yeah, she was really a funny woman. She was a terrific woman.
Eloise, it has been so wonderful to hear these stories and to have you on the air. You know, some of these stories I've heard before, but there's just no... substitute for hearing them directly from you over and over again, because they just resonate so much. This is the history that we want all of us story fans, all of our listeners need to be thinking about.
Well, I hope that you are telling your family stories, because you bring to life history in a marvelous way, and we need it. Need it.
Well, when you were just talking about your Aunt Catherine and when she shared her old WAC uniform with you, my mom was a WAC in World War II, and I think she was ambivalent about it. You know, she as a peace activist. In her later life, she would sometimes say things like she thought she'd been sold a bill of goods as far as the impact of her work. But there were times I took her to the VFW in Hagerstown for dinner one evening when she was visiting me there in town. And I had never been there myself, but my daughter had worked there as a part-time job. And I thought, you know, we should take Mom there. We should take your grandmother there for dinner. And I introduced her to the staff, who I knew a little bit as fellow citizens of my town. And when my mother heard herself introduced as a World War II vet, she did kind of a double take. And afterwards, she said she thought she was going to introduce herself that way from now on. So,
how beautiful.
It definitely was important.
She got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that the day that Cocky, she tells the story of how she was in the post office and she saw a big poster on the wall with the Uncle Sam pointing at her. We want you. And she decided to join, and she was scared to death. She only told her mother. She had three brothers, one of whom was my father. And they all ridiculed her, made fun of her, and any woman that joined the military in those times, you know, their families didn't like it always.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was sort of like, you know, they made aspersions to them that they would be less. They would be thought of as fallen women.
Mm.
And so she was afraid to tell them that she had joined. All three of her brothers, you know, were in the service, and I guess they didn't want to share. I don't know, but women were not treated so well.
Right.
You know, I'm so glad your mother had that, and that you had your hand in opening her eyes to her importance.
Well, she was a highly principled woman, and she wanted everything in her life to reflect what she believed. And I think she really had I don't think she would undo World War II. You know, I think she mm-hmm. was okay with the way that worked out for the world, but she was ambivalent about her own role in that. So it was a surprise to me. I didn't realize how conflicted she was about it until that episode.
Oh, that did give you a totally different insight into, you know, where she stood with that. I think basically it's like finally we have opened up to thanking a guy for his service or a woman for their service if mm-hmm. they served in the military, you know, and I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that they are giving service to the country,
yes,
and to everybody if they join and that they serve. You know, some welcome being told that, others don't. But somehow I feel like I like to say to myself that I've acknowledged.
Yes.
You know, I've acknowledged what he did. And ever since I've been going out to Arlington so often and really soaking up the atmosphere. And because I am a family member there, I talk to other families. I go down to the Section 60 where the veterans or the casualties of the Iraq and Afghanistan fights are, and I talk to families down there because mm-hmm. we share that ground in a funny way.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned a lot about the pride that the family has, and certainly I know about the grief that they have, but you get a different sense of it. And the other thing I think that people don't understand about Arlington, this is all mixed up together. You know, we're in Section 35, which is right down the side, the hill from the Tomb of the Unknowns, and in the next section going up the road are all the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little serendipitous to me.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big statue there for the nurses, and then nurses are buried there from World War One forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are honored and respected, I think it's a wonderful thing that we have that for people.
Well,
And what I've learned from telling that story is that people all over this country will come up to me after hearing it because they have a connection.
Yeah.
They've been there to a funeral, or they have for a friend or family member, or they have someone they love that's buried. Its tentacles are out all over the country. It's amazing.
Well, and it's those conversations that are so important, regardless of how you see war or you know, the current political situation. If we're not having conversations, if we're not listening to other people and sharing our commonalities, we're not doing our job as citizens. You know, we're not living here.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Here and
how
now.
Long have you been doing this program?
I think it's been almost 6 months, if I'm not mistaken. I should look
so
that
easy.
Up.
Oh, you're so easy as an interviewer. I just love it. You just made it so easy.
Well,
you
I was
it so easy for somebody to talk to you.
I've really been looking forward to this interview, Eloise. You know I've been trying to get you on the air for some time now, so
I knew this would be. I want to say one thing about this what's coming up. I'd just like to say to your listeners, don't miss Antonia Hosher. I've never forgotten a thing I've ever seen him do. He is a marvelous person, and I have interviewed him, and he is so easy to talk to.
Okay, well, I'll have to work on getting him on the air.
He has so many experiences, and he is so easy to talk to. He's a delightful man, delightful.
Okay, well, I'll repeat that information about his performance at the end of the show then. But in the minute or so before I close out the program, Eloise, tell us again how our listeners can get in touch with you and find out about your program.
The telephone number, the email is on my page for Ready to Serve, which is www.nurses.weebly.com. And I hope that anybody that's interested in this kind of history will find a time or a place that's convenient for them. And I especially would love to have everybody come to the World War One Museum in Baltimore. If you haven't been in that building, someday when you're in Baltimore downtown, go in it. It was built in 1925. And downstairs, the first floor is got a lot of pictures and memorabilia, but the third floor is an absolutely knockout room built in that period, and there are plaques on each section of the wall listing those persons who were killed from each county. Each county is recognized. And the other thing is that please watch. There's so much activity going on in the state of Maryland for events and celebrations that have already started, they're beginning, and they'll be picking up all over the state to commemorate the 100 years since World War One. And it's a long time for those people to wait in the dark.
to be recognized. Yeah.
So I think the state of Maryland, I've been tremendously impressed by what the network that's coming, some stuff is coming out of the governor's office. I mean, they're having a lot of things to recognize the contributions from the state of Maryland.
Okay. I need to close out the show. Eloise, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm really looking forward to hearing all of these stories again and again and again.
Thank you. Thank you, Fanny. Thank you. Love you for asking me to come and talk.
All right. Take care. We'll talk more. Bye-bye.
Okay.
This is Fanny Crawford on the Epic Storytelling Hour, closing out the noontime Epic Storytelling Hour on Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I did promise Eloise I would tell you one more time about Antonio Hosha, who will be opening the April performance, season 5 of Adam Booth's Speak storytelling series, usually on the second Tuesday, but this April, one time only, it'll be the third Tuesday, because that's when Antonio was available. Antonio Hosha is a mime and a storyteller. He'll be at the Shepherdstown Community Club, community building, at 7:30 p.m. on April 18th for the startup of season 5. And you can contact Adam Booth at speakwv.org or reach Adam at 304-886-9481 to get your tickets in advance, because that show may sell out. Antonio's very popular. Once people have heard him, they want to hear him again. So, closing out our show today, thanks so much to Eloise Schottler for giving us some background information about Ready to Serve, the story set that she's telling these days, and the Hello Girls, two stories about women who were active with the military in World War One and were the foremothers or the forerunners of women in the military today. The Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for music and then stories, literature, at www.enlightenradio.org. See you next week.